Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Today on Edgewise, we're talking to Doug Conant. Doug is currently the non-executive chairman at Avon Products. He's the founder of Conant Leadership. Also, he's the co-author of a very interesting book entitled Touchpoints, Creating Powerful Leadership Connections in the Smallest Moments. Of course, Doug's real huge spotlight in the not-too-distant past was he's CEO and director of the Campbell's Soup Company. So, Doug, in particular, I'm very interested in the work that you're doing with the Kellogg School, a special school you're setting up there and coordinating. Are the registrants for this school going to be CEOs?
Well, the focus is really on C-suite executives who aspire to lead their companies. And my observation has been that all of the MBA programs, because I've been working with Harvard, Wharton, Stanford, and Northwestern, Kellogg, and they all have really good programs that are always getting better for the leaders of tomorrow. But none of them have programs that are good enough for the leaders of today, the leaders who have to deal with the mess that we have today. And so I've been challenging the folks at Kellogg to strengthen the offerings for the leaders of today. And they got tired of hearing from me. So they said, if you think it's such a good idea, you do it. And I said, fine, I will. And I hope I didn't bite off more than I can chew. I'm pretty sure I didn't.
And what kind of programs will you be offering?
Well, the programs are going to be focused on helping C-suite aspirants prepare for the real life in the C-suites. They're going to be heavily practitioner-driven by people who have been there and done that, augmented by some of the Kellogg faculty. But the primary focus here is on experiential learning for people in the C-suite and above who want to learn, but they don't want to be taught. And so we have to create some meaningful experiences for them where they learn in conversation, where they learn by collaborating with their peers, and we'll talk about collaboration in a minute. So it's a different kind of teaching for an audience that has limited time available, but hungers to learn in ways that are relevant to the here and now, and that will help them with the challenges of the day. You know, my observation is that the paradigms we all started with as aspiring leaders, and I count myself there, having recently retired, those paradigms don't work anymore. We have to create new paradigms that acknowledge some mega trends that are going through the culture these days. And these new paradigms require some thoughtful work on the part of the leaders of today, and we can help. So that's the focus of the Kellogg School.
Doug, what do you think are the current defining factors of good leadership?
Jim Collins, in his work in Good to Great and his Level 5 leadership model, has the two differentiating characteristics of great leaders, and one of them is having fierce resolve, and it's sort of connected to resiliency. You've got to be incredibly well anchored and manage your energy well to be able to take on the challenges that our leaders are facing today. Metaphorically, you can just look at every presidential picture of what they look like when they took office and what they look like when they leave office. You see the wear and tear on the face of each one of those presidents. And I think it's true for leaders. We've observed in my work with Kellogg upstream, deciding to do this, that there are these two huge trends that they have to deal with that are unprecedented in the history of capitalism. One is the speed and the advent of the internet, so that every time I go out and speak, I talk to executives and I say, how many emails do you get every day? And I say, put your hand up, 100, all the hands stay up, 200. And the average is around 200 to 300. And then I say, well, how many text messages? How many phone calls? And heaven forbid you actually have to meet with a real person, go to a meeting. And then I hope the school doesn't call and say, Johnny's not feeling well, can you come pick him up? These people, all of these leaders, feel as if they're taking a sip of water from the fire hydrant of life. And the stress level, in my observation, is unprecedented in the history of capitalism on that dimension. And then, related to it, you have all these people expecting you to get back to them as soon as you hear from them. So the expectation in terms of your responsiveness has gone up. So you're dealing with more, and people are expecting you to spend less time and respond quickly. The other major trend is the demographic trend, where Tom Friedman was right. The world is flat, and now all of a sudden, you're managing a global enterprise. You're dealing with global issues. You are managing five different generations at work. You're managing an incredibly diverse gender population as well as ethnic population, all of which you never had to deal with when you were climbing the ladder of success. And I'm talking about the C-suite people. So they're awash in information, and they have this enormous complexity within the context of their workforce. In addition to all the other things that you normally have, which is shareholder pressure and tough financial markets and all this other stuff, and the leaders today are just under enormous pressure, and resilience is key. I have at my website something on foundational favorites, 13 books I had read, it's now up to 25, that arrived just in the nick of time and really sort of in the spirit of when the student is ready, the teacher appears. I read these books when I was ready to read them. And one was a book by Tony Schwartz and Jim Lehrer about the power of full engagement. And it's all about the challenge of making sure people have enough energy to stay actively engaged. It's really about energy management. And I think that connects to the spirit of resilience and the need for it in a big time way.
All right, so let's talk about another major thing that you're doing. And that's, well, you're chairman of the board of Avon.
That's something that was not contemplated, and we had some changes at Avon in advance of our last annual meeting, and after less than a year on the board, I magically had this opportunity. I'm very excited about it, and I'm very ready for it. I was involved 1,000 years ago in the rejuvenation efforts to bring craft back to life a long time ago. Then I was involved post-Barbarians at the Gate to get Nabisco up and running before we were acquired, and then I was challenged to transform Campbell. So I've been down this road of trying to help revitalize icon companies at all levels, and so I feel very ready to help here. It's easy to feel good about it when the board recruited Sherry McCoy to run it, and she is top-notch. Having a talented CEO who has the eye of the tiger for this work, and a good board, a very capable board that's getting better, it's exciting. I am actively involved in the revitalization of Avon and optimistic about our prospects.
Let's take a look at some of the things you did at Campbell's and how it relates to collaboration and communications. Because obviously, I believe those are very important responsibilities of a CEO or any head of a company. Now, for example, how did you use communications when you first got to Campbell's to build solid relationships with the employees who were already there?
There's a key thing that I do when I go into companies that I've been told is somewhat unusual. I haven't come across it before, that I think is foundational to this whole idea of communication and collaboration. The observation is that people are not mind readers. They hunger to know what a CEO really thinks and how a CEO is going to walk in the world that they live in. And if you watch CEOs go into companies, it takes months for the employees to begin to figure out what is he really like, what does he really want, and all of that stuff. And my goal is to take the mystery out of the relationship as quickly as possible. So the language I use, which is, there's a little section of it on our website in my over 30 years in the rearview mirror speech, and it's also captured in our book on touch points. But the principle is declare yourself. So the first hour of the first day, I meet with every one of my direct reports, and I share with them who I am, what I stand for, how I'm going to behave. And I cover everything. It's a little obnoxious. But in 1 hour, I tell them everything they could ever want to know about me. And at the end of the hour, I basically say, well, now you know me. I'm an open book. I just told you how I'm going to behave, how I'll react to bad news, good news, how I want to work with you, how I want to run the company, and where I'm flexible on how we do things, where I'm not. I even shared with you my favorite quotes. And at the end of the day, I'm going to be an open book to you from the first hour of the first day we work together. And if I do what I say I'm going to do, I guess you can trust me. If I don't, you can't, but at least you'll know. And so I do that with every direct report, and I invite them to come back and have their own hour with me where they share with me their point of view of their life as much as they want to. Only half of them take me up on it. And so from the first hour of the first day, we start going in terms of building relationship. The goal is to build the relationship before you need the relationship and not to waste any time. And I do that with every direct report. I did it with my board when I came. I did it with my board when they recruited me. I also did it with the company at large in a more modified format. And the goal is to just take the mystery out of the relationship so we can just focus on the work. And wherever I've been, it's paid enormous dividends. In terms of communication, I think declaring yourself as the leader and modeling that kind of behavior of transparency and a remarkable degree of openness and honesty, to whatever degree you're comfortable with it, is mission critical. And then I find everything gets easier because you set the tone and people feel more comfortable coming and talking to you. When I do my orientation, I talk about we don't believe in shooting the messenger, but we do believe in filling in the blanks for people and sharing challenging news. And earlier is better than later, and we talk about that so that it gets easier from day one. Is it perfect? No, but I'll tell you, it's much better than it would be if I didn't do it. That's probably the single different thing I do, and I highly recommend it to all the people that I coach and mentor. People are not mind readers. You have to get out front and tell them what you think and how you're going to deal with things. And then more communication within the company. The other thing we did, we would be very transparent to the degree we could be on what we were going to do, what was important. And a lot of times CEOs are always worried about the next thing. They don't go back and tell the organization, remember what I told you we were going to do? Well, we in fact did that, and here's what we found out, and here's what we're doing next. So part of this is once you declare yourself and you commit yourself to a path forward, it's awfully important to continually to loop back and say, we did what we said we're going to do, and now we're going to do it again, or now we're going to do this, and to complete the communication loop. So over time, people, if you do it well, people say, well, he's a person of conviction. He does what he says he's going to do. And the executive team does what they say they're going to do. It also means that when you encounter something where you can't do what you said you were going to do, you also need to go back and say, well, we couldn't, and here's why, and here's what we're doing differently. So that you establish this model that, you know, I'm going to do what I say I'm going to do. I'm going to be a person of good character. This team is going to be a high character team, and you can take that to the bank. And I have found that that's one of the two things required to build trust with an organization. Once you build trust, anything is possible.
Would you say that that international interaction with staff is a form of collaboration early on?
Well, I think it sets the table for collaboration. I think it starts with, it's a pretty one-way communication. And then you invite them to come back to you, and they communicate with you in a one-way process, and then you quickly start to collaborate. The Webster's definition of collaboration, which I used in a speech a long time ago, it is the notion of the collaboration. You work jointly with others, especially in an intellectual endeavor. And I see virtually all CEOs who have climbed the ranks see the value of collaboration with teams. But I think the place where we typically fall short is the time to collaborate is before you need the collaboration. And you need to build the relationship up so that when you do collaborate, you can be productive in the collaboration. You can't just be getting to know each other when it's time to get the work done. So my observation in corporate America is that we have to work further upstream to build relationships that will enable high-performance collaboration. It seems like we form teams and everybody has to get to know each other before you can get any work done. And that's just a waste of time. On important matters, the teams need to be ready to function right away. My observation is you have to spend some time upstream in the process, building relationships where high-performance collaboration is possible in a short time frame.
And you follow through with questions to ensure the foundation is firm, right?
Well, I think in building relationships, Stephen Covey was right. I think if you really want to have power in the relationship, you seek first to understand and then to be understood. My observation is if you want people to listen to you, typically, over time, they have to feel as if you're listening to them. If you're the person in power, you can get away with just telling them. But over time, they're going to have to feel heard if they're going to continue to perform for you. That's my observation. So if you want them to listen to you, you damn well better listen to them. Not only that, but they're closer to the action, and they typically know more than you do. So the language we use in our book is lead with listening. And I think that's where you start. You seek first to understand. Then as the leader, you need to be understood. But I encourage our leaders to lead with listening.
Also, you know, even asking the question, how can I help you?
Yeah, well, those words became very powerful and personal to me. And I think Bill George is right about showing up in an authentic way. You know, when he wrote Authentic Leadership and True North. How can I help, I think, is a mindset, but it also is very much me. I was fired from a job 10 years into my career, and I was sent to an outplacement counselor who every time he answered the phone would say, how can I help? This is Neil McKenna. How can I help? And he was there for me unconditionally, and he wanted to help me. And I would do anything for him. And as I went through that experience, which was traumatic, as I had lost my job, I went home to my wife, my two small children, and my one very large mortgage, feeling every bit the victim. You know, I felt lost. And here was this guy that was my lifeline who was just saying, how can I help? As I went through the process, I saw the power in that. And I have found over the years, if I bring a how can I help mentality to the work, whether it's with my board or with the company or with any stakeholder, the more I help them, the more they help me. It's a nice way to start it. It's altruistic in the beginning, but it pays dividends in the end.
In your book, Touchpoints, you point out how a leader's impact is built through hundreds, even thousands, of interactive moments in time. I seem to recall that part of it, that it's not just dealing with your direct reports, but dealing with staff at all levels and carrying, was it a watch? Something like that, to measure how many miles you put in every morning visiting people, a pedometer or something like that.
Yeah, the notion is when I do speeches, I have people recall. We all have these signature moments where we have that brief opportunity to meet a CEO or a chairman in a personal way, and we never forget it. You know, you've met some very important people, probably brief half hour, hour, or five-minute interactions, and you will always remember those moments. And you will make judgments on those people based on how they handle those moments. We all do. And as a CEO, I just remind other CEOs that you have hundreds of interactions in a day. And your employees and, in fact, all your stakeholders are going to make judgments about how you comport yourself in the moment. And one of my practices while I was at Campbell, we had American Heart Association Heart Health Month in February. And we had this program where we encouraged our employees to get 10,000 steps a day into their life. And we handed out pedometers to all of our employees. And we encouraged them to walk around between meetings. And for me, I was always having trouble getting exercise, but inevitably, there was a meeting that would end early or another one would, or I always had an hour or so during the day that freed up. And what we started doing would be, I would get on my sneakers and have my pedometer on, and I'd just start walking around the building, getting my exercise. What I was also able to do was increase my visibility with the rank and file employees. And I'd run into people at the loading dock and in the R&D kitchens and all over the place. And I'd have opportunities for brief interactions. And it was remarkably well received by the employees. And it also helped me get in touch with what was going on. I felt I had more my finger on the pulse of things. You know, it's no different than In Search of Excellence, managing by walking around. So it's not a new idea, but it's a powerfully relevant idea in a world which is becoming more virtual and where these personal connections are harder to find.
But the difference with you and other CEOs who do that kind of communication is that you don't necessarily only visit your direct reports. I don't know how many other times I've heard CEOs talk about their visits and how they try to maintain relationships. But inevitably, when you look into it, you find that it's the people in offices that they visit and not the people on the manufacturing lines or working at the desk in an open office.
Oh, absolutely. Wherever I went, but you know, and the challenge there was I couldn't be everywhere. And the way I augmented that wandering around was through my notes to people. We had a portal at Campbell that would tell me everything that was going on around the world. And every day I would write about 20 notes to people, brief notes on note cards, handwritten, in Shanghai or in Brussels, Belgium, or in Sydney, Australia, or Sacramento, California, Paris, Texas. People who were working on the line who had had a successful startup on this line, or somebody who had made a big sale in Bentonville. And I would send out about 10 to 20 notes a day, reaching the people I couldn't reach walking around. I did it handwritten so they knew it was me. And I did it in snail mail so it was unmistakable that it was me. And what was funny was wherever I would go in the world, you'd see all these notes up on the bulletin boards in all the offices. And so between my walking around and my notes, do you think my direct reports noticed? Absolutely. Do you think they started paying attention to their employees in a different way? Absolutely. So in the spirit of what Gandhi challenged people to do was be the change you want to see in the world, that's what I was trying to do. I was saying, you know, this is a tough world, and people need to feel that we're all in it together, and we need to show up, and we need, if we want them to take our challenges to them personally, they have to believe we take their lives personally and that we care. Again, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. When I had my near-fatal car accident in 2009, all those people that I've been stopping by and saying hello to or had sent a note to, every day in the hospital, we got thousands of notes back, which my wife and I would sit there and read. And we didn't send them out because we wanted to get them back, but it was clear we had made a connection with this organization that was based on humanity and that transcended the agenda of the day. It was incredibly gratifying. I find that when you put this out there in a well-intentioned way, it's amazing what comes back and what accrues to the organization and to the leader of that organization.
All right, just to wrap up, what haven't I asked you? What else would you like to tell us about?
I would tell you the language that I'm using these days that I think crystallizes the challenges for leaders today, there are two things I talk about, and it's pretty pithy. The first one is I think the challenge for leaders today is to be tough-minded on standards and tender-hearted with people, and you have to be both. You have to adhere to world-class standards of performance. The world won't tolerate anything less. But if you want an organization that will support you and work with you in an enduring way, you have to demonstrate that your heart is with them as well as your head. So tough-minded on standards and tender-hearted with people. And the last thought that's connected to it is, and this I heard from Jim Collins years ago, the notion, and it's captured in tough-minded and tender-hearted, is that leaders think they have to make choices. Do you want me to grow sales or earnings? Do you want me to take care of the bottom line or the employees? And his language, not mine, which was brilliant, was you have to embrace the genius of the and reject the tyranny of the or. You have to do both. You have to take care of the bottom line and the employees. And the landscape is filled with companies that are doing both. And those are the great companies. So embracing the genius of the and, rejecting the tyranny of the or, and bringing that to life, being tough-minded on standards of performance and tender-hearted with people. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
We've been speaking to Doug Conant, the chairman of the board at Avon Products, co-author of Touchpoints, Creating Powerful Leadership Connections in the Smallest Moments. Doug, thanks for being with us today.
Sure.
AMA webcasts bring you 60 minutes of thought-provoking insight, specific answers to your management challenges, and conversations with renowned thought leaders. Best of all, they're all free. For a complete schedule of upcoming webcasts, visit the events calendar at amanet.org/events. Here at the AMA, we value your feedback. If you've ever attended any of our webcasts, webinars, or seminars, you've no doubt encountered our feedback surveys. Well, our podcasts are no different. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.